It's great to be back in Montana. My wife and I were here 2 years ago roaming around in Helena and north of Helena in Dearborn, looking for the spirit, I guess you could say, not the ghost exactly, but just the kind of spirit of Gary Cooper. There are biographies of Gary Cooper. There are mentionings of him in every Hollywood history, of course. He's a little bit of an obscure figure now. People still know the name, but they don't know a whole lot about him. I was able to interview some folks who had known him, including his daughter, Maria, who was very, very good and very, very interesting on it. But, of course, most of his contemporaries are gone, and Cooper himself died in 1961. So I felt like, well, I've got to go everywhere I can to try to see something about this guy. And I ended up in Montana, and the Montana Historical Society was a great place to go. Going to Dearborn, where the remains of the 600-acre ranch his father had bought and where Cooper spent much time, beginning at age six, was there. Seeing his birthplace in Helena, all of that. But it was just a wonderful experience to be up there and great to be in such a beautiful, striking place. And I think I did get a much better sense of who this guy was and how he captured so many hearts and entertained people for so many years. It's very generous of Montana State and the museum and the center at Montana State for bringing me back here to talk about this, and I'm delighted to be here and delighted to be with you. As most of you, well, let me ask you this. How many of you have seen High Noon? Pretty good crew. And how many have seen a Gary Cooper movie other than High Noon? A few less, but still a pretty good turnout. So I think we know, you know, where we are demographically, and surely most of you know that, you know, there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, when the Western was the most popular pop culture genre, you know, in all of movies. These were stories, you know, they had horses, they had cattle, they had beautiful landscapes, they had cattle drives, they had good guys who wore, for the most part, white hats. Exception here, and bad guys in black hats, and they had lovely, obedient women at home, and some of these movies were thrilling and wonderful, and some of them were just plain terrible, but they were stories about ourselves and about our country and about our mythic frontier origins and about our masculinity and about what a wonderful country we were, and so many of these myths, of course, were born in Montana. And have been maintained here over the years. But in the 1950s and 1960s, Westerns were the biggest thing going. Something like one-third of all the movies made in Hollywood in the late 50s were Westerns, and one-quarter of television shows were Westerns. And Westerns on TV, you know, fed the Westerns in the movie. Movies. People got their start on TV Westerns. People like Steve McQueen and James Garner, and they graduated from there to Hollywood Westerns. And it was a big thing going. And, of course, one of the biggest of all, one of the most enduring, was High Noon, released in 1952. Now, the thing about High Noon is I think that even for people who haven't seen High Noon, they still kind of recognize what it is. They've heard of it. They've heard of the idea of it. They've seen this image of the, you know, of the lawman, of Gary Cooper in his black hat and white shirt, and he's got that holster strapped to his waist, and he's got the badge, you know, striding down a deserted Western street toward a showdown with four armed killers. The title itself, I think, has endured all this time and has become legendary. It's about a moment of truth when a good man has to face overwhelming odds to defeat evil, or at least to confront evil. And High Noon has been beloved by generations. Presidents love High Noon. It doesn't really matter their political ideology. Dwight Eisenhower saw it three times and rooted for the lawman. Bill Clinton says he screened it 20 times when he was in the White House. You know, I guess the White House is kind of a lonely place where people sometimes think, where presidents sometimes feel that they're being left with the hardest possible decisions, and their political allies and friends are kind of, you know, ducking them and looking the other way. But it's not just presidents of different ideologies, it's the political movements have loved High Noon. In 1989, Solidarity used Cooper's image in its campaign poster in running in Poland's first free democratic election. And that's Cooper with the Solidarity platform in his hand and a Solidarity badge just over the lawman's shield. The movie itself was filmed in just 32 days. It was on a shoestring budget, and it was really kind of a rush job to fulfill, you know, the tail end of an old contract. And yet it vaulted almost immediately to critical acclaim. It had big box office numbers right from the start. The taut narrative, the powerful performances, the evocative theme song, and the climactic shootout at the end, all of these things kind of got together to make it an instant classic. And it won 4 Oscars, including, as Andrew mentioned earlier, Best Actor for Cooper. And even today, it is one of Hollywood's most enduring films. So here we are 65 years, you know, still addressing it. And each generation, as is usually the case, has read into this film its own politics and its own values and sensibility. But I think what was largely forgotten about High Noon over the years is that it was written and filmed during the height of the Red Scare and the Hollywood blacklist, a time of political inquisition, really, and personal betrayal, and a time that I think has some distinctive echoes of our own turbulent, difficult political age. In the middle of the film shoot, its screenwriter, Carl Foreman, was called to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities about his former membership in the American Communist Party. And Carl understood that it wasn't going to be enough for him to stand before the committee and swear to be sworn in and just say, yes, I was once in the American Communist Party between the late 30s and the early 40s. I left it. Big mistake on my part. I'm very, very sorry I was ever in there. And that was going to be enough. He knew, because there had been hearings being held for several months, that he was going to have to do something more than that. That to prove his loyalty, he was going to have to accuse other people of being communists, to finger other people as subversives, to name names. So for Carl, it all comes down to this. Either he betrays his friends, or he loses his job and the wonderful career he's been building and working so hard for a decade or more to achieve. And as he pondered what to do about this, he began to rethink the screenplay for High Noon, and he turned it into an allegory about the Red Scare and the blacklist. And the marshal, the lawman, the Gary Cooper figure, is now Carl himself. And the bad guys coming to town to kill him are the members of the committee. And the hypocritical and cowardly citizens of Hadleyville, where the marshal is marshal, they're the folks in Hollywood, Carl's friends and business partners, who either stand by passively or betray him. As I was writing the screenplay, it became insane, because life was mirroring art, and art was mirroring life. This is what Carl would say later about it. I became that guy. I became the Gary Cooper character. Now, I guess I could stop here and say, if you want to find out what happens, the book's for sale out in the lobby, and I'll be out there later signing it, and we'll quit here, but I'm not going to do that. But I am going to start at the beginning. In the beginning, because we're in Montana, the beginning has to be with Gary Cooper. He was born, actually, in a very comfortable Victorian house on the corner of 11th Avenue and Raleigh Street in Helena in May 1901, and he grows up there. And he arrives in Hollywood at the age of 23 in November 1924, broke and unemployed at the age of 23, as I said, coming from hometown. He was actually the son of British immigrants who had come to America to seek their fortune. Both of them had arrived in the 1880s in Montana. They didn't know each other. They met in Helena, got married, had 2 sons. Cooper was the youngest of the two. And being a movie star was really the furthest thing from his mind when he came to L.A. He actually wanted to be an artist. One of his sharpest childhood memories was of seeing, well, I'm sorry, first, this is the home where he was born. But one of his most memorable childhood moments was seeing the mural by Charles M. Russell of Lewis and Clark at Ross Hole. Anybody know where this mural hangs today? It's at the state capitol. It's actually in the House of, behind the Speaker of the House of Representatives on the wall. It's a vast thing. It's been there since 1913 or so. And Cooper loved this, and this is what he wanted to do when he grew up. He too, you know, he's a child of the West, but he's also inspired by the legend of the West, which this is. His father was a lawyer. In fact, he was appointed U.S. Attorney for Montana by President Teddy Roosevelt. And later, his father becomes a member of the Montana State Supreme Court. And after he retires from the bench, he winds up moving to L.A. with his wife to handle a very big legal case, and they end up settling in L.A. And Cooper goes there that first Thanksgiving of 1924 to be with his parents, and he never left. He was tall, he was handsome, he had a killer smile. He had smoldering blue eyes and a quiet, laconic manner that and sort of great personal charm. He's both insouciant and modest at the same time, and I can't help but think that some of that is stuff he learned, you know, in this state. And the other thing he learned in this state, of course, is how to be a cowboy, because he was a real cowboy. He knew how to ride. He knew how to shoot. And right away, he gets work in Hollywood. Because they're making Westerns, and he's a stunt writer, and he's an extra in some movies. And although he really has no formal training whatsoever as an actor, he quickly becomes a star. You know, people like John Wayne and Humphrey Bogart, they labored for a decade or more to build their celluloid persona, the way they talk and the way they walk and, you know, and the kind of roles they get. It takes them a long time to become stars in Hollywood. Not Gary Cooper. I would say that within 3 years of arriving in Hollywood, his name is above the title of every picture he made, and it stayed that way for more than 30 years. He was the ultimate product of the Hollywood system. He made two or three, and sometimes in those early days, as many as five movies a year. He was seducing his female co-stars and just about every other attractive woman he met in Hollywood during that time. And he was making wonderful, successful films like Mr. Deeds Comes to Town and Meet John Doe, The Pride of the Yankees, and For Whom the Bell Tolls. This particular photo is from The Devil in the Deep. That's Cooper with Tallulah Bankhead, one of the many, many women who carried on with him at one point or other. This is from 1932. In any event, he wins his first Academy Award for Best Actor for Sergeant York in 1941. And that same year, the Associated Press reports that he made $483,000. That was the biggest salary in Hollywood. But after World War II, the studio system is starting to decline. Audiences are discovering new ways to spend their entertainment dollars. People are moving to the suburbs, but most of the big movie houses remain downtown. In 1948, the Supreme Court requires the major studios to divest themselves of really the most lucrative part of their business, which is to say the movie theater chains that they owned all around the country. They could make the chains, you know, show any movie they wanted it to, and that's going away. And of course, the biggest destructive force that's coming on over the horizon, like a huge, unstoppable tidal wave, is television. So between 1946 and 1949, the annual weekly attendance in the movies drops from 90 million people. 90 million people go into the movies every week to 60 million, and profits plunge something like 70%. But the problems Hollywood's suffering at this point are more than financial. The war had changed American attitudes and perceptions, and the old films were no longer really meeting the change. When the boys come home from the battlefields overseas, they're coming back with new thoughts, new ideas, and new hungers. That's what Daryl F. Zanuck, the head of 20th Century Fox, told his staff when he came home from the war. We've got to start making movies that match the new climate of the times. And one response in Hollywood is a series of, you know, or a group of thought-provoking, socially conscious films, including Gentleman's Agreement, which is about anti-Semitism, All the King's Men, Body and Soul, The Best Years of Our Lives, which looks to be a romantic comedy here, but actually is a very powerful film about the problems that war veterans have in adjusting back to civilian life after World War II. Now, Gary Cooper is 50 years old in 1951, and his career is beginning to fade along with the studio system. The roles he's being offered were increasingly mediocre. I mentioned earlier that I'd met and talked to his daughter, Maria Cooper, interviewed her. She lives in New York, though she's been to Montana many times. She was a lot of fun to talk to. She said to me about this period in her father's life, they would send him these crappy scripts. At some point, you have to do one of them. He was furious at the quality of the material. I mean, he really was stuck. He couldn't direct his own movies. He didn't write his own movies. He couldn't produce them either. He relied on the studio system, and the studio system was letting him down. His health was slipping, too. He had a bad back that he had from a childhood car accident that never healed properly. He had ulcers. He was smoking two or three packs of cigarettes a day. And his marriage was beginning to unravel. He had separated from his wife of 17 years, and he was coping with his very talented but very tempestuous 25-year-old mistress. That would be actress Patricia Neal. Here the two of them are in the movie The Fountainhead in 1947. Anyway, at this stage in his life, Gary Cooper really needed a break. And fortunately for him, one was on the way. So while the old studio system is really beginning to slip badly, a number of small, independent, little entrepreneurial companies are starting up, and they're getting a foothold in Hollywood. I guess today we would describe them as nimble, you know, startups, lowering the cost of entry into the movie business. But they're making cheaper and smarter films. And one of the most successful was led by a very ambitious young filmmaker, film producer named Stanley Kramer. This is here's Stanley on the right with Marlon Brando in 1950. Stanley Kramer had arrived in Hollywood in 1936, just out of college. And he worked his way up through the system, doing just about every low-level kind of job you could get in Hollywood. He built sets, you know, using hammer and nails and carpentry. He cut films. He edited films. He worked for three or four of the studios in those days. He served during World War II as a documentary filmmaker in the Army. And that's where he met Carl Foreman. These were two young, ambitious, fast-talking Jewish intellectuals from New York and Chicago. They were both the sons and grandsons of immigrants from Eastern Europe. It's striking, you know, in researching this book, how many of the people I'm writing about turn out to be the sons or grandsons or immigrants themselves. Each of these guys, Stanley and Carl, had a deep hunger to succeed. They were wildly ambitious. They also had a social conscience. And finally, they had a withering contempt for the studio system. We saw things pretty much alike on the subject of filmmaking, Kramer would say later. Both of us could tell the world what was wrong with the film business and what had to be done to correct it. And after the war ends, Stanley scrapes together a little cash and he starts a business that eventually becomes called the Stanley Kramer Company. And naturally, he turned to his friend Carl Foreman to be part of it and to write scripts. Their first hit was Champion, about a ruthless and avaricious working class boxer named Midge Kelly. Anybody seen Champion? Just curious. One or two. Anyway, Midge Kelly pounds his way to the top and steps on his friends and his family to get there. And Carl's screenplay was tough and remorseless and very powerful. And this movie stars a handsome young newcomer named Kirk Douglas. As it happens, another son of Jewish immigrants. So my favorite interview for this book was with Kirk Douglas. 2 years ago in his home in Beverly Hills. He was 98 years old. Recently, he celebrated his 100th birthday. He was still trim and charismatic. He had a full head of silver hair sort of pulled back and a little ponytail in the back. And, you know, he's not a large man, and a little wispy and small, but just a lot of fun to talk to. And he told me he was mesmerized by Carl Foreman's screenplay for Champion, and that he was determined to play the part of the anti-hero, even though his agent tried to steer him away. I mean, it's a small company. They won't pay you much money. You're going to play, this is a very, you know, unpopular role you're going to play. You don't want to do this. But Kirk really, really wanted to do it, so much so that when he went to appear before Stanley and Carl in Stanley Kramer's office, He ripped off his T-shirt to show these guys his muscles, his musculature, to show that he had what it takes to play a boxer. And, you know, indeed, there he is. And Champion, to everyone's surprise, I think, but maybe Stanley and Carl's, was an immediate hit. It cost $550,000 to make, but it grossed almost $18 million over the years. And it was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Actor for Kirk Douglas. This is his first starring role in movies, and he's nominated for Best Actor, and Best Screenplay for Carl Foreman. And suddenly, Stanley and Carl are very hot prospects in Hollywood. And they go on to make Home of the Brave, which is a sort of searing drama about racial prejudice in the military during the war. And The Men, which is Marlon Brando's first movie. He plays a paraplegic war veteran at a VA hospital in Southern California. And Cyrano de Bergerac, an adaptation of the Broadway hit in which Jose Ferrer gets the best actor Oscar. And it's not just the sort of hard-hitting, mostly contemporary subject matter and the wonderful performances that make these movies so successful. It's also the way they're made. They're made on skin-tight budgets in black and white, but with a very, very, very talented team of mostly young professionals doing the film editing, the artists drawing up the sets, the screenplays. All of this is done, the music. It's all done by a bunch of very interesting, hungry professionals, and they do it beautifully. And Stanley Kramer recruits a very gifted director, Fred Zinnemann, to join the company on a 3-picture deal. And Fred, as it happens, is also an immigrant, a Jew from Vienna, who comes to Hollywood in the mid-1930s. And Fred had worked for more than a decade at MGM, one of the big studios, where he was known for his meticulous craftsmanship, the documentary film style that he used, and also, finally, for his undisguised contempt for the studio system he was part of. And the fact is, MGM was rather happy to see him go, but Stanley was very happy to get him. So High Noon really had a lot going against it. Carl Foreman had never written a Western before, and Fred Zinnemann had never directed one. The screenplay Carl wrote had no beautiful vistas, no Indian raids, no cattle stampedes. But what it did have were beautifully drawn characters and a taut, realistic dialogue without, I would say, a wasted word. I think I counted up in the last 12 minutes of the movie, the Gary Cooper character has 6 or 8 words. And it also has a suspenseful story that unwinds in real time. You know, the marshal is married to his new bride on a Sunday morning at about 10:30, 10:35, immediately gets a telegram telling him that a guy he had arrested years ago and who'd been tried and sentenced to death and then had his sentence commuted has now been released from prison and is coming back on the new train to kill the marshal. And the guy already has 3 armed thugs in town waiting to meet him at the train. So you've basically got about 80 minutes between 10:40 and noon for this story to unwind, for the marshal to try to line up help in town to face these bad guys. And the script abounds with shots of ticking clocks. And the suspense builds really with every scene and with every moment. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but the clocks get bigger as the movie goes on. Fred Zinnemann films them a little closer together each time. It's sort of like a version of, you know, the TV show 24. It also has a haunting theme song, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, which was written by Dmitri Tiomkin, the music by Dmitri Tiomkin. He is another, he's a Jewish immigrant from the Ukraine, and Ned Washington, who is actually imported only from Scranton, Pennsylvania. And it's performed by Tex Ritter. And it plays throughout the movie. There are different portions of it played almost a dozen times. And it's unusual because it advances the story with its lyrics in ways that no movie song had ever done before. The title, remember, is Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling. And it is the lawman addressing his new bride, the woman he's just married, and pleading with her to stick by him in this terrible moment. And what's so fascinating is that the lyrics of the song explain the marshal's motives and his fears in a way that the Cooper character in the movie can't do. He's most famous for saying something along the lines of, well, if you don't understand it, I can't explain it to you. But Tex Ritter is explaining it in the song that we hear throughout the film. So it's got that going for it, and it's also got great performances, of course. Stanley hired a very talented young actress to play the Marshall's new bride. Grace Kelly was just 21 years old in 1951, but she was already an experienced stage actor in New York. And she'd even made some commercials for that new thing, TV. Kramer loved the way she looked, of course. He also loved the fact that she was willing to work for $750 a week. And the same was true of Katia Jurado, a young Mexican actress who had already was already a big star in Mexico, but had only been in one previous American movie. She was hired to play the lawman's former mistress. And these are two very strong women characters, highly unusual, I would say, for 1951. But I think the biggest coup that these guys hit was in snagging Gary Cooper for a bargain price. Cooper knew a good role when he saw one, and as I suggested earlier, he was desperate for a good role and for a good script. But interestingly enough, both Stanley and Carl were rather reluctant to hire him for this. They saw him as the product of the old-time studio system, the system they disdained. He was kind of a relic, Carl recalled later. Plus, he was 29 years older than Grace Kelly and maybe about 8 inches taller. And so they were really worried that this match wasn't going to work at all. But I think he brought an authenticity and a vulnerability to this role that really was one of the prime reasons why High Noon became such a classic film. And again, I think this authenticity and this vulnerability was something that was born in Montana. So Carl served as associate producer for the picture, and he put together the locations and lining up the rest of the cast. Even though Cooper worked for less than half his usual salary, they only had $30,000 left to spread among the supporting cast. So it was kind of like constructing a human jigsaw puzzle. Everything had to fit together just perfectly. And you know, in the end it did. But there was one obstacle that Carl really couldn't overcome. So the House Committee on Un-American Activities had held its first public hearings on alleged communist infiltration of the movie business back in 1947. And here's a picture of the hearings, and you might notice there to the left that smiling guy down below, handsome guy, that's Gary Cooper. At first, the committee called a bunch of what they called friendly witnesses to testify about the question of communist infiltration. And Robert Taylor, the head of the Screen Actors Guild, and Gary Cooper, and Walt Disney, and a handful of other personages appear and offer their advice and their opinions on this matter. Some of them name names of people they think are communists. Cooper did not. Anyway, after that, they called 10 other folks, screenwriters, directors, and producers, who became known as the Hollywood 10 because they all refused to cooperate with the committee. All of them had been members of the American Communist Party in the 1930s and early 40s, and most of them still were. But at first, they had a lot of support from the film community. Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, Danny Kaye, and a plane load of movie star liberals flew in from Hollywood to Washington to protest outside the committee room. Even Ronald Reagan, who had just become the head of the Screen Actors Guild, even he questioned the committee's bully boy tactics. But by 1951, the atmosphere was very different. The Hollywood 10 had been convicted and sentenced up to a year in prison, and their convictions had been upheld by the Supreme Court. This is 7 of them, incidentally, in Washington, climbing the steps of the federal courthouse. So they all went to prison for up to a year, and after they were released, the committee decided it was time to come back to Hollywood for a sequel. It's really hard to overstate just how intense the fear of communism was in those days in the United States. The Soviet Union had just announced it had developed the atomic bomb. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and their co-conspirators had been arrested and accused of stealing atomic secrets and giving them to the Russians. By September 1951, more than 83,000 American troops had been killed or injured fighting communists in Korea. And at home, the progressive political coalition that had ruled the United States for more than a decade under Franklin Roosevelt was really beginning to unravel under Harry Truman. And self-styled Americanists, and these are some of the members of the committee, including a very earnest young Richard Nixon on the right, self-styled Americanists believe that outsiders were taking control of our institutions, of our government, of our schools, of our culture. These people were usurpers, people, and they were liberals, they were Jews, they were communists. In those days, those were the ones singled out then. Today, I guess you could say Muslims, refugees, undocumented immigrants. These people allegedly had stolen our country, and the self-appointed guardians of American values were determined to get it back. And their anger and the rhetoric of that time was just as corrosive, just as vicious, really, as anything we're hearing today. In fact, I think for many Americans, communism posed a threat even more alarming than, say, the threat of terrorism in the modern era. I mean, communists, after all, could be anybody. Neighbors, relatives, close friends. They looked and sounded just like us, after all. And yet they were agents of a ruthless foreign power whose goal was to destroy the American way of life. They were the enemy within, the masters of deceit, as J. Edgar Hoover put it. Quote, "A communist is a completely transformed, unrecognizable, and dedicated man." This is according to a spokesman for the American Legion at the time. "While he may retain the physical characteristics of the rest of us, his mental and psychic processes might as well be from another planet." In other words, they were like the Walking Dead, only super smart and very, very, very scary. Now, the Communist Party in Hollywood had actually never been very large or influential, and it was down to perhaps 100 members by 1951. Didn't matter. The studios decided to fire and blacklist anyone who could refuse to cooperate. You know, in truth, Hollywood was really more of a sideshow to the larger struggle. I have to say that no atomic secrets were ever traded or stolen in Beverly Hills. And no acts of sabotage or espionage took place there either. But the symbolic power of Hollywood, its extraordinary high profile, and its abiding role, if you will, in our national culture and in our fantasies, made it an irresistible battleground. The same reason the very small Communist Party came out in the late 30s to try to recruit people there was the same reason that the House Un-American Activities Committee came there in the late 40s to root it out and to make hay over it. And the truth is that few people and institutions would acquit themselves well. Not the committee, certainly, which far exceeded the constitutional limits of its powers and acted basically as judge, jury, and executioner for the people it called to the stand. Not the studios, who caved out of fear of losing profits and prestige. Remember, they were economically vulnerable in 1951. Not political liberals, for that matter, who found themselves trapped between a bullying committee on the one hand and its dogmatic communist targets on the other, and who, by and large, ended up enabling the blacklist. And certainly not journalists, my cohort. Now, there were some journalists who were, you know, gossip columnists like Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons, who were, you know, right-wing anti-communists who invited the committee to come to Hollywood and cheered from the sidelines. But also the mainstream, what we call the mainstream media, the great newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the New York Herald Tribune, they also failed, I think, fundamentally to hold a critical spotlight to the process of repression. For example, hearings were held, and those hearings were privileged. If the committee, if a congressional committee holds a hearing, as a journalist, you're entitled to print everything that's said at that hearing without fear of being sued. But the problem was, when people would be named as communists in those committee hearings, the newspapers would publish those names without ever bothering to get in touch with the people who were named to get their response. And if people wanted to be taken off that list, they would have to come testify themselves weeks or months later, after the die was already cast. So this was not exactly journalism 101. And not the way we teach it, either at Montana State or at the University of Texas. The Jewish community, I have to add, also failed in Hollywood in many ways, failed to defend the civil liberties of its own members. People lost their jobs. Business partnerships unraveled. Friendships were destroyed. Even families were turned against each other. And, you know, it's interesting. In studying this, I found the bitterest conflicts weren't between, you know, political enemies. Nobody expected the committee to be nice to them. The real conflicts, the ones that really, really hurt, were with your friends and your former business partners and your allies. These were intimate conflicts. These were, you know, conflicts over betrayal. And these were unresolved, and in many ways, they're still unresolved today. So when Carl Foreman was first subpoenaed, in the summer of 1951, Stanley Kramer, his friend and business partner, gave him his full support. But as the time grew nearer for Carl to testify, Stanley grew more and more fearful. He and his business partners had just signed a very lucrative 5-year movie deal with Columbia Pictures. And they were all going to make a lot of money, including Carl. And they very much feared that if Carl refused to cooperate, that would kill the deal. And Kramer and Foreman actually were also somewhat at odds over the movie itself. Stanley didn't like the dailies of the film as he was seeing every evening. Fred Zinnemann's gritty documentary style looked too dark and unappealing to him. He also didn't care very much for Gary Cooper's minimalist acting style. He seemed not to be acting, but simply being himself. That's what Stanley would say later about it. I think Cooper could have played the marshal in his sleep. There were times I thought that was just what he was doing. It wasn't a compliment. So Carl Foreman, dressed in a dark blue suit and what he called a very sincere tie, took the committee witness stand on Monday morning, September 24th, 1951, in the Federal Building in downtown L.A. And when asked if he'd ever been a communist, Carl denied he was one now. And otherwise, he took the Fifth Amendment for every question. He refused to name names, refused to say if he'd ever been in the Communist Party, and his testimony took less than an hour, and he was done. And the very next day, Stanley Kramer issued a statement through Columbia Pictures saying, "A total disagreement between Carl Foreman and myself exists. And the stockholders and the directors of the Kramer Company would be meeting as soon as possible, and, quote, necessary action will be taken at that time." They didn't wait, Carl later said. They quit right then and there, and they threw me to the wolves. And Stanley and Carl, these two once close friends and colleagues, never spoke again. Carl's widow, Eve, told me that there was a day many, many years later when her husband and Stanley Kramer ended up in the same elevator at Columbia Pictures, and they just simply looked forward, you know, at the door. They don't look at each other. Not a word is spoken. They get to the floor. One of them goes out. Never spoke again. Carl's lawyer eventually negotiated a settlement with the company, with the Kramer Company, but Carl had to agree to surrender his associate producer's credit for the film. And soon after that, he announced he was going to start his own independent production company. And although Gary Cooper was a conservative Republican and a very strong anti-communist, you recall seeing his smiling face testifying in 47 as a friendly witness, but he had grown to trust and admire Carl Foreman while he was working with him on High Noon. He liked him a lot, and he believed him when Carl told him he was no longer a member of the party. And Carl said, and Cooper said, "Use my name when you announce the new company." And Cooper agreed to buy shares of stock in the new company. And that was quite wonderful for Carl. But immediately, Cooper came under extraordinary pressure from the right-wing gossip columnists like Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons, who questioned in their columns what this celluloid icon of American values was doing, you know, buying stock in this company started by this ex-commie. And Cooper's right-wing Republican pals, including the great John Wayne, also asked the same questions. And Cooper takes off for Sun Valley, Idaho, where he goes on a hunting and fishing expedition with his good pal, Ernest Hemingway. And a few days later, still in Sun Valley, he calls up Hedda Hopper to tell her that while he's still convinced of Carl Foreman's, quote, loyalty, Americanism, and ability as a picture maker, unquote, he had decided to withdraw. So that was it. Carl's hopes of working in Hollywood were now shattered. And several months later, he leaves. He moves to London. He lives there for 25 years after that. He gets off the blacklist eventually, but for several long years in those days, in the 50s, he's on it. And he writes screenplays under a pseudonym, largely. And one of his greatest achievements while there is to co-write the screenplay for The Bridge on the River Kwai with another blacklisted screenwriter, a guy named Michael Wilson. So you can almost see down at the bottom there where it says screenplay by Pierre Boulle. The Bridge on the River Kwai screenplay won Best Adapted Screenplay for won the Oscar in 1958. Wonderful moment. Problem was that Carl and Michael didn't get any credit for it. Pierre Boulle, who was a French novelist, who had written the novel, The Bridge Over the River Kwai, but who didn't speak any English and certainly didn't write in English, he got the Oscar for Best Screenplay. And it wasn't until 1984, 26 years later, that the Motion Picture Academy recognized that Wilson and Forman were the actual writers of the screenplay. And they held a nice ceremony, and the Oscars were handed out. And the people who came to collect them were their widows, because both Michael and Carl had long passed away. So besides the political warfare, there were creative conflicts over High Noon, as I suggested earlier. Stanley didn't like the director's cut that Fred Zinnemann gave him. He said it was flabby and boring. It didn't have the suspense that he wanted. And he says he saved High Noon by recutting it himself. The film editor, Elmo Williams, says he's the one who saved High Noon, and he did all the editing, edited it to perfection. He also claimed that he had the inspiration for Do Not Forsake Me, O My Darling, for the ballad. Then Stanley said he was the one who was the inspiration for the ballad. Needless to say, Fred and Carl disagreed rather heatedly with both these guys, and with each other, ultimately, in some ways. And, you know, it's not uncommon for folks in Hollywood, which is a rather Darwinian place, of course, to argue endlessly over who should get the credit for saving a great movie. I think they're still arguing over who should get the credit for the use of the mechanical shark in Jaws. But it is true that the conflicts over High Noon, I think, were bloodier and more enduring, in part because of the political bloodshed of the blacklist. So my book tells the story of the making of this classic American movie against the backdrop of this very tumultuous, difficult era in our history. And the meaning of that era is still unresolved, I think. It's true that no one was put up against a wall and shot during the Hollywood blacklist, but it was a time of hysteria and persecution, and many, many innocent people were hurt. I don't pretend to have all the answers to the questions that still surround the blacklist, but I have had the advantage of being able to look at the committee's investigative files, which weren't released until 50 years after the hearings. I've seen the investigative files, I've seen executive session transcripts, and that's helped me get a better feel for who was doing what to whom and what the testimony was really about. At the same time, I've been able to uncover some previously unpublished interviews with Carl Forman, actually a lot of interviews with Carl Forman, who was hoping to write his own memoir and had done a series of interviews with a writer friend before he grew sick and died suddenly. Also with Stanley Kramer and with other folks involved in the making of High Noon. And that allows me, I think, to give a slightly more, I hope, to give a more plausible account of who actually deserves credit for the greatness of the film. And the short answer, not to be too glib about it, is I think they all deserve credit. I think High Noon is a true collaboration among some very, very gifted people in Hollywood. And that, ultimately, what my book is about is how this small group of highly talented people came together to make a compelling creative work, and what happened to them when they came up against the machinery of political repression of that era. And it raises the question that I think history demands of all of us. If we were confronted with the same terrible choice that these people faced, in this case, between betraying our principles or losing our livelihoods, in other words, when the clock strikes High Noon, what would we do?